The other dependent character of enlightenment has been fully realized. All there is the absence of the impetitional. However, this thing, because of its evolution, is in close relationship with all beings who have not yet arrived at this state. And it's emanating Dharma to them, which they convert into images. But it keeps pulsing this Dharma, and it keeps saying to them, the word you're using to interpret this teaching, like, for example, Prajnaparamita, those are just words. This wonderful teaching is just words. And to the extent that this wonderful teaching is just words, it's perfect wisdom. It says that kind of stuff to us. But it actually has gone beyond words and has no karmic consciousness. But when it relates to us in such a way that we can convert it into our own stuff and receive the teaching. Yeah.
So for us to abandon that, we have to be quite comfortable with letting that fantasy go.
Yeah.
And then something new, maybe it's not...
Quite comfortable with... You have to be quite comfortable with it. Okay. Anyway, you're willing to let it go. You might not be comfortable, but you might be willing to let go even if you weren't comfortable. You have to practice a lot of compassion towards the clinging to being and the affliction that comes with clinging to being. You have to practice a lot of compassion with that. Even if it was uncomfortable, you still could say, okay. Would that be like accepting the death of every moment? Accepting the death of every moment would definitely be... Pardon?
That's the reality of our being.
The first practice that... If you want to understand this teaching, the first practice is generosity. And generosity welcomes whatever, you name it. And so it would welcome whatever. It welcomes the most wonderful dream and the most horrible dream. And then after it welcomes it, it practices ethics with it, and so on. And all the while, the bodhisattva is listening to the teachings, which she's not yet completely ready to accept because she's not yet concentrated enough, and she's not concentrated enough because she doesn't yet completely accept. She's not completely generous and ethical and patient and enthusiastic with everything. But when she is, she's ready to be completely one-pointed. And when she's one-pointed, then she can realize that these teachings are one-pointed with phenomena. The phenomena are these teachings. So what you're saying is one of the things which one would accept. So we can have some other things to suggest. They also will be treated the same way. We practice generosity with everything on this path, or we aspire to practice generosity with everything. Otherwise, we're postponing entry into the definitive characteristics of phenomena. We're postponing entering into reality. But we can also be generous towards postponing entry into reality and be patient with that we're postponing our work. Yes? What about unconscious imputations?
Yeah, for instance, being afraid of something, you're not sure what it is that you're afraid of. There's some imputation going on. You don't know what it is.
Well, here's another part of this teaching, okay, which is set up in the previous chapter, chapter 5, where it talks about mind, I think it says mind, thought, and intellect. Or you could also say mind, thought, and consciousness, which again shows you that in the Indian system, all these things are basically, they're all talking about mind, but different aspects of it, okay? So this teaching, the foundation of everything we know in this teaching is, let's say, the results of your past karma. And the results of past karma, there's many results of past karma, but the main one that we're emphasizing is that there's a consciousness which is the result of past karma. The result of your past karma, one of them is a certain consciousness, and that consciousness is also, generally speaking, unconscious. It's not a consciousness that knows things in an active, specific image way. It doesn't know images. The way we know images is based on the results of the past ways we've known images. And the results of the past ways that we've known images, okay, that's unconscious from the point of view of knowing something as an image. But it is a knowing. It's a knowing in the sense, it's this basic sense which we are, sometimes we think we're conscious of, but when we're conscious of it, I haven't said what it is yet, but when we're, I'll just say what it is. It's a basic knowing that there's a world. It's an awareness of a world. It's awareness of an enclosure. But it is not awareness of that being an object like an image. It's just an awareness of a world. And we can be also consciously aware of a world, but then we make the world into images in our conscious life. So this is called the storehouse consciousness. And part of the reason it's called storehouse is it kind of stores the results of past action, a past active consciousness. And this is also, this is the other dependent. So I sometimes use the example, we can speak English, most of us, but we don't know how this ability to speak English, we don't know what supports it. But what supports it is that we've spoken it quite a bit before. And the results of speaking it before are supporting us to now speak it in a way that we know. But we don't know the way we're able to speak it. We don't know how our past actions of speaking English are supporting our present English. However, the way we speak English transforms. Right now we have this unconsciousness which supports our ability to speak English. It supports our ability to speak English to ourselves and others and talk about the Dharma. It supports us thinking that practicing was good. It supports us remembering the teachings we've heard. Because we've heard teachings before, we can remember them consciously.
That stuff is afflicting the way things are.
That stuff is afflicting the way things are. Yeah. But it's also, it's not so much that that stuff is afflicting, it's grasping that stuff as being what's going on that's afflicting. So you have a teaching which says if you grasp your active images of what's going on as being what's going on, if you grasp that, that is affliction.
What's the alternative?
The alternative is listen to a teaching which tells you that, and if you watch how you're doing it, that has a different effect than if you do it without being aware of it. If you can see how you have a story about somebody and you can see that you believe it as that's what they really are, and you can kind of see, again, through your imputation, you can kind of see and believe that this is causing problems. So without giving up your story of the person, you just realize that that's all it is. And then you start to see that that actually loosens things up a little bit. And you start to imagine, again, it's just an image, but you start to imagine if I didn't hold all to my story of people, but I still had them, there would be no stress. There would be no affliction, and that's correct. If you didn't hold it all, that would be similar to abandoning that. And when you abandon that, you know the absence of these stories in the person. So you have a person, you have a story of them, and you understand the absence of your story in the person. So now you're looking at the person, and you've got the story, and you also see suchness. You don't have to get rid of the story. You just have to realize this story is completely absent in what it's about. So then you see suchness simultaneous with the story. And that suchness purifies the past karma, which is supporting the story-making. Story-making continues because there's a lot of past stories supporting the story-making. But even before you see suchness, even before you know suchness, and how do you know suchness? By abandoning the imputational. How do you abandon the imputational? By understanding the imputational. By seeing how you're tell stories and how you believe that they're about something, you understand how affliction works. And also you understand how imputation works. When you understand how imputation works, you can abandon the afflicted character phenomena. And when you abandon the imputational, you can see the thoroughly established. So learning these teachings transforms the basis for imputation. The basis of the imputation is what's being imputed upon. The other dependent character is supporting, that's why they're so intimate, the other dependent character supports the imputation and the imputation afflicts the other dependent character, which supports the imputation. But also, the imputational can receive teachings which will cause the other dependent to change in ways which will support the imputational to take itself less seriously. So all the teachings we receive get converted into imputations of these teachings because all the teachings have another dependent character. All the teachings have an inconceivable, ungraspable character. All the teachings have a thoroughly established character. All the teachings have a suchness character. But also all the teachings have an imputational. They all are able to be imagined. As we study and understand the process of imagination, we abandon the process of imagination. It doesn't mean that we don't do it anymore. It's just we let go of it. And we don't hold it as being what it's about. And what it's about keeps supporting it to be functioning. So it keeps being generated and abandoned. And as it's abandoned, we see the thoroughly established.
The other dependent feeds the imputation.
Doesn't exactly, you could say feeds it, yeah, feeds it, or support, it's the support. It'd be good if you said that more slowly for me. The imputational character, the other dependent, is a support for our fantasies. And then when the fantasy...
Since the other dependent, everything's dependent on everything else.
Yes.
In a way, it's sort of feeding the imputational character that then creates our fantasy.
Yeah.
Because the fantasy is dependent on the thing that it's a fantasy about.
That's right. The fantasy is... Well, when you say it doesn't mind, what is it that doesn't mind?
The other dependent character doesn't mind.
You can say that the other dependent character, which is dependent co-arising, you can say it doesn't mind, but you can also say it does mind. And the way it minds is called suffering. It suffers. It is afflicted. It's not arguing with it, though. It's just afflicted by it. So the afflicted, our afflicted life together, the afflicted aspects of the dependent co-arising of the universe supports the process of knowing, which afflicts it more. So the total reality has these three aspects. One is that it's interdependent, but also interdependence has supported the formation of living beings who have imaginations, and they use their imaginations to know something that is not knowable by imagination. But they try anyway because they love to know. I mean, I shouldn't say love, they're addicted to know. But there's a way of turning this process around. And that's what we're looking at now. And the way of looking around, turning around is to study the process of addiction to knowing, to see how addicted we are to projecting images on our life so that we can know it. And we take the images as being what's supporting them, which is not. And that the fact that the support of the addiction and the support of the grasping so that we can know, that support is inseparable from that. And that support is stressed by that. It isn't just that we're imagining suffering. There's also a support for that. And there comes a time when the support for the imagining of suffering is not there anymore. The suffering that we're imagining is just the word suffering. And there's not another suffering. There's not another suffering other than that one. I should say, that suffering doesn't refer to, and there's no objective support for that suffering that we're imagining. But if we don't understand that, then there's another suffering, which is inconceivable and which we can't know.
So, in other words, in experience, we impute something on the experience itself is just the experience itself.
Yes, but if we hold, if you excuse me for saying so, if we insult the experience by thinking that our idea of it is it, it kind of hurts the experience. Our life experience is actually free. And our life experience is actually afflicted. It's both afflicted by our holding to our stories of it, and it's free of it. So as I said before, the Buddha did teach that there is basically a luminous mind, but the luminous mind is afflicted by defilements. And this luminous mind can be freed of the defilements by studying the process of defilement. So the other dependent is afflicted phenomena. The imagination stuff isn't really afflicted. It's the afflictor. It's not the afflictor either. It's that when you adhere to it, when you hold on to it, that causes affliction, but not just imaginary affliction. It afflicts this chain of causation of creating suffering. But when you start to study this process, it starts turning the process around, and the other dependence starts evolving towards realizing the thoroughly established, and when it fully realized, then that particular evolutionary process will no longer support any imagination. There'll be no karmic consciousness being supported by that other dependent character of life. However, that fully evolved and fully realized other dependent character keeps in relationship to all other sentient beings who have not yet realized this. So this teaching is coming from the total transformation of the other dependent character. Like it says here, once the bodhisattvas have seen or realized the thoroughly established the suchness, they keep meditating on that. It isn't that they realize it and then it's all over. They realize it and then they keep cultivating it for a long time. How do they cultivate it? In conjunction with the imagination. So there's still imagination still going on. Other dependent characters still there supporting imagination. And they're cultivating suchness along with this process and transforming the other dependent character into a Buddha. Somewhere along the line, speak up, please.
Yeah, somewhere along the line, because in my experience, there just seems to be a lot of karmic consciousness to go through.
So, right! There's a lot of karmic consciousness to go through.
Somewhere along the line, because it seems to me that the karmic consciousness is endless, not just my experience, just in general. Somewhere along the line, the imputation stops. Where does that happen?
I think I know what you mean, but I'm talking about a somewhat different story.
Okay.
I'm talking about a story where it isn't that there is a little, there's some pauses in where the imputation stops. There's a place where there's no conception, where there's no projection. That's called non-conceptual wisdom. That's a little kind of like click in the process. And before you had this non-conceptual wisdom, you also have conceptual wisdom. So you can actually, while you're still aware of the teaching of conscious construction only, you actually understand it. And you no longer believe that things are something other than conscious construction. You can actually see this is just a conscious construction, not the slightest bit more. That's called a kind of enlightenment, where your belief in a self ends. This is part of the Buddhist path. You work along and you actually stop believing in this sense that something exists in addition to the way it appears. That this appearance refers to something substantial, or this appearance has substance, rather than this is just a conscious construction. You get to that understanding, and then to take the next step into fully realizing this thoroughly established character, you abandon even the teaching of conscious construction only. So there's a pause there where there's non-conceptual wisdom. However, and so you actually have realized suchness. Okay? Now, you give that up and go back to conceptual wisdom. You apply that suchness to the process of imagination again. And that's how Buddha qualities are developed. Strictly speaking, you're not developing Buddha qualities prior to wisdom. You're getting ready for wisdom. Once you have wisdom, then you do the same practices you did before, but you don't believe that your story about them is them. You don't believe that anymore, but you still have stories of them. Like you say, I want to practice compassion today. You still have the story, but you see, there's an absence of that story in the practice of compassion. You see that. You see the suchness. But you're not completely in the suchness because there's images. However, this process gradually transforms the basis for karmic consciousness so that there's no basis for it anymore. And then there's no karmic consciousness. But sentient beings, as I'll probably talk about maybe a little bit more and I've talked to you about before, case 37 of the Book of Serenity is called karmic consciousness or active consciousness. At the beginning, Guishan says to Yangshan, if someone comes up to you and says, all sentient beings just have karmic consciousness, boundless and unclear and giddy, with no basis to rely on, how would you, test this with them? So all sentient beings have is karmic consciousness. All bodhisattvas have is karmic consciousness. Until you finish the bodhisattva course, you have karmic consciousness. But if you use karmic consciousness with these teachings, that way of using it transforms the basis and transforms the basis into more practice and transforms the basis until there's no basis for karmic consciousness. And then there's no sentient being there. There's no bodhisattva. And there's no Buddha, really, either. But that's fully realized now. And that's what bodhisattvas want, to get to the point where they're just pure Buddha body, pure Buddha, teaching sentient beings how to understand their mind. But they don't use their karmic consciousness to teach them. They don't need it anymore. They now use sentient beings' karmic consciousness to teach sentient beings. But this thing that's teaching them is the result of transforming karmic consciousness together with the support of karmic consciousness. Karmic consciousness we know about. It's what we know as our active life. It's supported by the results of karmic consciousness. So this teaching is there's two levels of consciousness. One is the active, and one is the latent or subliminal or supportive. It's the supportive active consciousness. It's the result of active consciousness which supports karmic consciousness. So karmic consciousness is evolving together with its support, and as karmic consciousness works more with these teachings, the support evolves to support more and more practice, more and more study of suchness, more and more study of suchness with karmic consciousness. You're using karmic consciousness to study suchness. Karmic consciousness is studying its own imagination. It's seeing how its imagination is characterless. It's abandoning its imagination as being what it's about, and it's transforming the other dependent character, which then supports more practice, more realization of suchness, until the support of karmic consciousness is over and all there is suchness. But this suchness, again, is not like some vague thing. It is this inconceivably powerful force of teaching sentient beings. But it's not a sentient being anymore, because sentient beings have karmic consciousness. Bodhisattvas have karmic consciousness. But at a certain point in their practice, they are already free of karmic consciousness, and they're using that freedom to work with karmic consciousness in such a way as to make Buddha qualities. I get this strange feeling that, like, almost everybody here understands what I said.
But this is the next thing from what you said. So I can understand how to work with thoughts like imputations, like I'm hot or I'm comfortable, temperature's perfect or it's not, or even things about. Oh, okay. So there's some things I understand how to work and to watch that process, and there's some things that I believe so deeply that I can't find a starting place. And I'm wondering if you could help me.
You mean you get into a situation where you believe something so strongly, you think, maybe this teaching doesn't apply to this?
The teaching, I'm sure the teaching applies.
Yes.
I look at it, and I go, but it's really happening.
It looks real to me.
Yeah, right. And so when you have something like that,
well, if I look at something and I think it's really happening, I think, well, the teaching says that this is a normal situation and this is affliction. So I'm the Dharma's here. I really believe that this person is wonderful. And if anybody disagrees with me, watch out. Because this is really true. This person is wonderful. And there's no room for negotiation here. And I'm really stressed. I can see that I'm stressed, and I'm on the verge of violence if anybody would disagree with me. I can see that. But then this is the teaching. The teaching would say that's the way it is. When you strongly adhere to what you think is going on, that's stress. And if you see that, you're practicing. So tell me what the problem is now. Because that, to me, it seems like, well, now this is practice. Is you notice that when you have a view and you hold to it, you see that that's poisonous water. You're in poison water because you are holding on, but at least the teaching says that's what it's like. When you're rigidly holding to your view of what's going on, you're not being very compassionate. I should say, your compassion hasn't reached the point of where you let go. You need to love this situation. You need to be more compassionate to this situation until you can say, okay, like Judith was saying, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to not adhere to this story. Yes.
So, I saw where the sticking point is.
Good. See, that's the thing. See where the sticking point is.
Yes. But so the sticking point is I'm adhering to a belief about harm being done to large numbers of people.
Yes.
And other beings.
Yes.
And there's clearly a fear in here that if I stopped adhering to that belief, I would stop helping.
Yeah. I've heard that quite a few times.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's being proposed to you is that when you have this story of many beings are being harmed, this is your imputation upon the other dependent character. If you strongly adhere to that, you're going to be stressed, or there's going to be stress and suffering, okay? Now, you're afraid if you would not strongly adhere to that, that you wouldn't care about beings anymore. Isn't that what you said?
No.
Oh, what did you say? Tell me. No, but wait a second. If you did not think that beings were being harmed, then you wouldn't have any harmed beings to be concerned about. That's true.
Right, yeah.
That's right.
I think that beings are being harmed.
Right, well, if you think beings are being harmed...
The difference between thinking something and adhering to something.
Well, just a second. You said before you're afraid that if you stopped adhering to that beings are being harmed, that you might not think that beings are being harmed anymore.